Climbing Gold is a production of Duct Tape Then Beer.
Oh, your wife is calling me.
Oh, what the heck? Tell her to get it.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. We lost our guest because my wife is Classic.
Sorry, team.
Yeah, no worries. Maybe put it in Do Not Disturb.
Okay, perfect.
But Sonny was probably calling you to tell you that she sent her prod and she's all fired up.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. Up at Jurassic Park?
Yeah, she went to the death. She's all psyched. So you want to just start with your name and what you do?
Okay. So my name is Sandy Russell. I currently run a small creative agency called Sandy Russell Creative, but I used to work at Google doing global brand marketing for Google Maps, Earth, and Street View, which meant I did a lot of fun projects like April Fool's, Santa Tracker, and then doing other just like fun projects, fun impactful projects with Street View and Earth.
Are the Street View and Google Earth projects, are they more impactful or fun?
I mean, both. It depends. Like, so for example, I mean, you've seen some of this work. Like when we did the Mont Blanc project, we used Google satellite imagery to like actually look at how climate change was advancing in the Mont Blanc region. Like you could see the glacier shrinking.
Yeah.
So, you're like, no.
No, I agree.
It's 2015 and Sandy is this Google Maps storyteller. She's taking this very powerful but kind of utilitarian tool and figuring out how to turn it into something that totally shines, into something that can go viral.
So the idea was to capture places that were important to cultural heritage. And around the time that I came on was this idea of how we could, one, expand the program because the technology was expanding. So where are new interesting places we could take the Street View technology? And two, when we're capturing these places that are really important to our cultural heritage, who are actually the people that bring them to life? That's where you come in.
Ooh, I mean, why does climbing even count as part of our cultural heritage?
I mean, a couple different things. One, clearly, like, we didn't just want to get Western European history, and, like, that's why we were going places like Angkor Wat. So, in general, we wanted to kind of expand that definition anyway. Two, it wasn't necessarily about climbing. It was about Yosemite and how to bring the Yosemite to life in a new and interesting way.
And so what did that wind up meaning for this project?
So, one is we got individual panos of you guys. So, you, Lynn Hill, and Tommy on key parts of El Cap that were really like significant. So we got like Lynn Hill on the Jardine Traverse. I think we have a photo of you doing the King Swing and clearly Tommy on the Dawn Wall.
On a 6 mil rope, I remember it because we were, it was all very scary. Because we were filming it every time I swung back and forth, I was like, is this the time my rope's gonna cut? I was like, we'll see.
Yeah, as a person on the ground, I'm just like, oh my God, but it all worked out fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was one of those times where I was too committed to authenticity because I'd soloed the nose that way. And I was like, I should use the gear that I used when I was soloing it. But in retrospect, I definitely just should have used a big fat static rope because if you're up there posing, like who cares about authenticity?
If I remember that shot, you're like, we see it from the bottom, even so we don't even see the rope that you're on.
Yeah, well, it was authentic and I was very scared.
Yeah, that's great. But then the second thing that we did that I'm sure you remember is we got the first ever vertical Street View. So we got Street View from bottom to top of the nose. And it was which I think it was like 300 panos or something like that. That was really interesting because that was the first time Street View had ever been done in a vertical fashion. And it was actually a huge challenge.
I still remember that was harder than it sounded. Because I was the one that actually climbed the nose for Street View. And I had the little backpack on with the tripod sticking out the top and the, what was it, like 6 GoPros at the time? You know, when you have a backpack with a thing sticking up above your head with a huge ball on the top, anytime you move side to side, you clunk the cameras against the wall. And so if you scratch any of the lenses, then you have to stop, move the lenses around, we had lens covers, I think, so I could hit them once or twice and then take the covers off, and then you'd hit the actual cameras once or twice, and then it's kind of game over. You have to, like, tilt it around so that one's facing out or facing down or something, so... But it's surprisingly hard to climb the nose without ever jostling your back. You know, it's like, I mean, they're chimney pitches. They're like all these things that it's like, and all the hand cracks, like in corners, you know, normally it's like a V and you're all wedged in there. And if you lean forward, then the camera hits the wall and you're just like, oh, geez. And then we had, what was it, 5 or 6 hours of battery life? So we wound up doing it in two halves. We climbed the first half in 5 hours and then climbed the second half in 5 or 6 hours, 2 different days. But I was like, what an undertaking. It was fun.
Nobody else could have done this collect, like between the battery life and like knowing the nose and being able to move around. Like not only were you guys critical to capture as part of the story, but you guys were like a key rigging team. 10 out of 10 recommend.
And the end result was this suite of content that people could go climb the nose on Street View. They could check out this YouTube video behind the scenes. when Google launches it in the summer of 2015, it goes crazy. It's the number one trending topic on Facebook when that was still a thing. It's picked up by the evening news across the country, and the New York Times runs a front page story. Had you climbed El Cap at that point?
Well, I had not done the nose at that point, and I had not been up El Cap. Actually, the first time I was at the top of El Cap was for the shoot, and it was amazing and definitely like very inspiring. And I was like, I want to climb this at some point, and got to do that a couple years ago. Or last
with my
year,
wife.
I guess. Yes, with your wife. It was great. I did the King Swing approximately 20 times. Turns out it's much harder than you made it look.
This is how the gospel of climbing spreads. Santa takes this bit of inspiration, that same feeling we've all felt, wanting to share the sport we love with others. She connects Yosemite legends to engineers and creatives. And before long, Alex is climbing the nose with a street view camera strapped to his back, so the rest of the world can follow along.
You know, it's like in 2015, the fact that Google Street View wanted to do something on El Cap felt so novel. It's like, that is cool. You know, like, that is interesting.
We were all like ignored little children that needed attention at that stage, right?
Yeah, well, kind of. I mean, I think I did that project for free probably because I was just like, this is cool. And, you know, you're just like, yeah, I'll go work on El Cap for a bunch of days just because this is a cool project.
And Sandy's snowball, it becomes a giant snowball that wraps up tens of millions of eyeballs and imaginations. Sandy's project is a giant snowball. Well, 2015 is the year climbing becomes an avalanche.
I'm Alex Honnold.
I'm Fitz Cahal.
You're listening to Climbing Gold. Actually, out of curiosity, do you do any sports? Like, what do you do for activity?
nothing. I walk up and down my stairs. I run a little bit. I do some trail running here.
This is the person who may be responsible for climbing's astronomical growth in the last decade.
You know, hiking and camping kinds of stuff.
Like casual trail running or like serious ultra running?
No, pretty casual. And the older I get, the more casual it gets. Yeah. and if there's a category called trail walking, I'm starting to veer into that one a little bit more.
That's a crossover with hiking, right?
Yeah, I prefer trail walking.
Cool. So you want to just start, give us the basics, your name, where you're from, what you do?
Yeah, my name is John Branch. I'm a sports reporter for the New York Times based in the Bay Area of California.
He's actually kind of being humble. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist from the New York Times, whose in-depth coverage of the Tunnel Creek avalanche at Stevens Pass set the bar for multimedia online journalism.
Cool. And what's your connection with rock climbing?
I don't have one, actually. Yeah, it's just a beat that I kind of stumbled into probably 10 years ago, and I'm interested in it. I think it's fascinating. I think it's...
Were mainstream sports in the Bay Area too boring, and you had to broaden your beat to include Yosemite? Or, you know, how like why climbing?
Yeah, so in 2012, I was living in New Jersey, covering sports, you know, on the East Coast, but kind of all over the place, and I was doing a lot more stuff out west where I'm from, and so I moved to California. They moved me to California in 2012. And as part of that, I wanted to kind of expand what we did away from like the main four sports or the main sports. And so I was just always on the lookout for stories more in the adventure realm, I guess. I remember I did a story about abalone hunting here. And when I first moved out here, I was just kind of looking for things out of the regular realm.
That's when you know that the NBA season is slow when you're covering abalone hunting in the Bay.
Exactly. Yeah, it was pre-Warriors dominance, I guess. So I was just looking for things that were just different.
Yeah, how did you first learn about the Don Wall?
Yeah, we had mentioned it a couple times in the Times, I think in like 2011, 2013. So I was vaguely aware of what they're up to. And what's funny about all these things, Alex, is that, you know, one of the tricky things is that we tend not to write about people who have hopes and dreams of doing amazing things. As you can imagine, I get pitches every day from people saying, hey, I'm going to run across the country. I'm going to kayak from pole to pole. Love for you to cover it. And I usually respond by saying, yeah, let me know when you're done. Sounds like maybe it could be a cool story. I'm not interested in writing about things before they happen because then it just becomes promotional. Probably helps them raise funds, whatever. We see a million of these things. These ideas just kind of blow up. So part of the trick is trying to figure out what's legitimate and what's not, and what's really going to happen and what's not, and what do we jump into in the middle of if it looks like this is actually going to happen. And so a couple days into those guys on the Don Wall, my editor called me, and I was actually down at the Rose Bowl because it was January 1st. And he said, those guys are up on the wall. Are you interested in doing that? I'm like, yeah, let's see what happens. And what's funny is that I, on the night of January 2nd, I must have driven back from LA to San Francisco. I was just looking into it, and I remember I was on my couch downstairs here, jumped online, and I saw Kevin Jorgensen was on Twitter. Like, he had just posted something, and I'm like, what is he doing on Twitter? I thought he was up on the wall. So I sent him a note, a Twitter note, and I even wrote this down. At 8.02 p.m., congrats on the push so far and continued good vibes. NYT is quite interested in the story ASAP. What's your hoped-for schedule? Cheers. At 8.05, 3 minutes later, he responded with a screenshot of their hoped-for schedule and said, hey there, this is the best-case scenario. A lot could change, but we will definitely be up here for another week. Let me know how I can be of help. I was like, holy cow. I'm like talking to him. It didn't occur to me I could like connect with him that quickly, if at all. And so I said, I think I'll drive up to Yosemite first thing in the morning. And that's what I did. You know, it's funny because there was no like great ambition, no grand plan to any of this. If I remember I was telling my editor, I'm like, well, I was supposed to go to Denver to cover the Broncos. There was a Broncos game or something, and I was like, going to go to Denver. I'm like, you want me to go to Denver? Should I go over to Yosemite? He's like, yeah, go to Yosemite. So just very serendipitous how it all worked out.
So you're saying that Tommy and Kevin beat out the Broncos for sports coverage?
Somebody else, I'm sure, covered the Broncos.
Well, yeah. I prefer to think that the Broncos got no coverage.
they got no coverage. The Times just said, forget the NFL for a week or two.
January 3rd, 2015.
I drove to Yosemite first thing that morning, and I was like amazed that they had cell service. Like, it didn't occur to me that you guys have cell service up the side of El Cap. It's probably the best cell service in the valley, maybe. I don't know. But I was trying to find cell service before I called them. And so I was like driving around, like, okay, looking at my bars, going, where can I call them from? Got a hold of them at that morning, like at 9 or 10 o'clock, and talked to both of them and went somewhere, stayed the night there, and cranked out a story. And it turned out going on the front page of the paper the next morning. Not my decision. Some editors read it and said, this is great. Maybe it was a slow news day. I don't know exactly what was at play there back in New York, but they liked the story, and they put it on the front page the next day, and off we were going.
And so what happened with that story? I mean, it really took off. Like, tell us about the...
Yeah. So it captured the imagination within the newsroom. And I think once it ran and went online, obviously it got a lot of readership. I have no idea what the numbers were, but it did something to make us think, oh, we should keep doing this. Maybe we should follow this along. And so Jason Stallman...
That was John's editor at the time.
Texted me or emailed me the next day. And I went back and looked at my texts. He wrote, you up for profiling Caldwell next or prefer something else? And I was like, yeah, I guess I'll profile Caldwell. And so I spent like the next day or so profiling Caldwell. If I remember right, I think I dragged you into this. I did drag you into this because a lot of the questions from readers were like, how does this work? What is this climbing? How do they do the ropes? How do they go to the bathroom? You know, we're getting all sorts of funny questions from readers. And I didn't really have the bandwidth to deal with it. And maybe I didn't know all the answers myself. And so we thought, let's get some experts. And so since I had just met you a few months before that, I was like, hey, Alex, can you help us out? And you helped us do a reader Q&A sort of throughout those next few days. Meanwhile, I'm going to go try to dig up everything I can about Tommy Caldwell's backstory, and wrote a profile of Tommy that ran on the front page again, probably 2 days later. You know, back-to-back A1s on this, and we were kind of off and running. And it was like, okay, I guess we're just going to follow the story to its conclusion.
We'll be back with more after the break.
Tommy, were you surprised by the level of interest the mainstream media took in the Don Wall?
I think before Kevin and I went for our big push, the climbers were paying attention. But then when we were on our push and John Branch started publishing the articles in the New York Times, that's when it really blew up. And I was completely surprised. Like, I mean, of course, nobody, I don't think that had really ever, I mean, I guess it probably had happened in climbing before, but you know, certainly not in my generation in a way that I understood. So it seemed absurd. Like, I fully still don't understand it.
Pretty quickly, we grabbed our graphics team, and we have, I think, one of the best interactive graphics teams going. They do a lot of stuff off of my stories, and so I'm always really proud to work with them. And they had some really high resolution shots that they had gotten of El Cap and then mapped out their route as they went along. this really sort of 3D interactive that you could sort of play with El Cap. That then ran, you know, a few days into this. And so we started to like invest more resources, you know, being like, let's bring the graphics team in this. Let's make sure we have a photographer. Let's keep John there now. And so we decided just to kind of roll with it as far as it would go. You know, and we didn't know exactly how it would end. I think probably halfway through, we realized at least Tommy was going to top out. But then it got dramatic in the middle with Kevin, which I think sort of added suspense to your point, too. And this is nothing that, you know, I had any part of it all. But then all of a sudden, I think they were starting to get calls from all the different news stations, right? They were, you know, Good Morning America was calling and PBS NewsHour was calling or whatever else. I think that's maybe just part of the thing with the New York Times is that, you know, when we say it's a story, I guess some other people think, oh, I guess it's a story we should be paying attention to, too. We gave some sort of imprint, I guess. And so other people followed along.
It's being called the climb of the century. On a sheer rock cliff 3,000 feet above Yosemite National Park, professional climbers Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen are attempting to do what no climber has done.
Yeah, I mean, after that first interview, you know, something struck a chord. Everybody started paying attention. And we did feel that. Like, we were getting lots of requests. At one point, actually, Kevin and I just had to have this conversation. And we're like, how are we going to deal with this? Like, we can't spend our whole days just doing interviews. And it just all felt kind of stressful to think about the fact that so many people were watching us, especially since Kevin was in the middle of, like, failing, basically. And so we actually made this decision that we weren't going to accept any more interview requests or anything. Like, the only thing we're going to do is outgoing. We're going to do our little Instagram posts, and that was it.
Famously, Tommy at some point dropped his phone. I think he was sort of fed up with the attention that came pretty quickly, and somehow the phone slipped out of his hand, supposedly.
Or he's just slightly clumsy, you know, which,
or he's just like, you know better than anybody. Whatever happened, the communication slowed down quite a bit after those first couple days.
Yeah, and he went on to send quite easily, so, you know, there's obviously some there could be a correlation between dropping your phone and sending.
Yeah, there could be. Yeah, I don't know if it works for you better. Like, do you find, you know, when you're off the radar and away from public attention and doing stuff on your own, maybe it's just easier and you're a little more focused or something. But he was I think he was glad to sort of get away from that. And I don't know, whatever conversations he and Kevin had, I mean, I don't know if he ever said, hey Kevin, I can't believe you actually responded to that guy on Twitter message a few days ago or not. But, you know, had Kevin not responded to me, this might have been a whole different thing.
So the last day climbing to the top, or the last 2 days really, we had this sense that something crazy was going to go down, because, you know, the news trucks were building. Everybody knew that we were going to basically succeed and make it to the top.
This morning, two climbers are celebrating a historic moment in their sport. Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen reached the summit of El Capitan in Yosemite.
A story we've been following from the start.
Kevin Jorgensen and Tommy Caldwell.
Yeah, they topped out. I was up there when they topped out, and there weren't a lot of people up there. You were up there, and there was, I don't know, 20 people up there, maybe?
Yeah, maybe 15, 20 people.
Yeah.
And then when we topped out, that was when it was really crazy, because there was, you know, 50 people up there. You know, President Obama was trying to get a hold of us. Yeah, it was super insane. And that was really, like, those last few days and then that moment of topping out were when it really struck us how sort of insane the media event was.
I slept there that night and left. And the next day, I think those guys had to get up for the Today Show like at 3 a.m. or something. And then they did a news conference in the valley there. And there were all these TV trucks. And because we had written all these stories up to this, we didn't feel like we had to, like, write like the day after thing. So I was just like, you know, washing my hands of it. And I remember walking by going, you guys all have fun. I sort of felt like we kind of, like, left those TV trucks to kind of clean up everything we just did. Like, you know, we spent a week doing this. And now we're leaving, and new TV trucks have fun talking to Tommy, who can't talk right now because he lost his voice.
From Yosemite, along with Tommy's wife, Becca, who's helping out because her husband has lost his voice. Good morning.
That was amazing. I remember that at the press conference. He was so, I mean, he could barely, it was like a whisper. He could barely speak. And there are all those cameras and all these people. And you're just like, man, yeah. He was like the shell of a man, but
you think that was real too? You think he lost his voice for real, or was that like the telephone?
He was worked. Well, actually, not that maybe physically worked, but yeah, he was sick or something.
I'm sure.
So in 2015, a lot happens, right? There's the Dawn Wall, of course. Maru gets released in theaters. It's kind of the first time something plays in the Cineplex. Free Solo gets greenlit later that year. There's the Google project, right? So how do we know that climbing grew? The opening of climbing gyms. It takes about 2 years to come up with the idea and then open your doors if it goes well, maybe 2.5 years. So if you look at 2017, 2018, what you see is that the number of gyms opening in those years almost doubles. Alex, my memory is that you have read Malcolm Gladwell's Tipping Point.
Yeah, I did, but I do not remember a thing about it. I mean, it must have been more than 10 years ago.
Well, the very quick summary is that, you know, basically it's about the mechanisms that create social epidemics. Like, it's how ideas become popular, how all of a sudden, like, everyone owns an Instapot, or, like, why large swaths of the population will begin thinking or behaving in different ways or new ways. And one of the key arguments that Gladwell makes is the law of the few, that an idea is virally spread by a few key sets of people. And the first group is connectors. They're like social butterflies. They're people who inhabit different spaces in society.
Well, I mean, I think in the context of what we're talking about with this growth of climbing, I mean, I think Sandy fits there, as she's working for Google, knows a lot of people, interested in a lot of different things, and wants to bring them together.
The second group are the mavens. They're the people that like collect information. They're curious, sometimes about like obscure, random stuff. They're like tastemakers. Their word carries a lot of weight. People listen to them.
Yeah, so in this case, I guess John Branch is the maven, someone who, I mean, as he said, interested in the obscure sports and sort of the fringe sports. You know, his word certainly carries a lot of weight, considering he's publishing it in the New York Times. You know, it's like he has a huge he has a huge platform. He has a lot of weight behind him. So even if it's not his personal, you know, it's not necessarily him personally that carries that much weight, but you know, he certainly packs a big punch.
He's got a good megaphone.
Yeah, he's got a really big megaphone.
Yeah. And the third group are the salespeople. They're like the people that believe deeply in the movement or the product or the idea. And I'm curious whether you agree with this, but like in the case of climbing, I think it's got to be the people. It's got to be the gym owners, right?
I'm not sure. I'm trying to decide. I mean, yeah, that is an obvious, like, climbing gym owners are obviously salespeople because they are literally trying to sell climbing to the masses. But on the other hand, I don't know. I kind of feel like the media in some ways sells it even more than the gym owners.
Yeah, or like even thinking about just like the Jimmy Chins and the Renans of the world that are.
Yeah, exactly. Those are the salespeople.
Yeah, that's a great point.
But the true salespeople are the media types who are selling to non-climbers, you know, the people who are like putting this lifestyle in front of the mainstream public and encouraging them to quit their job and get in a van, you know, like that kind of, like that's the true salesmanship.
There's like so many moms whose hearts have been broken by like their kid moving into a van. I thought they'd be successful.
Yeah. You know, you gotta play the long game.
Yeah.
Eventually, you'll be proud of something they did in that van. Did you think it would have an impact on climbing? Like, you know, what did you think?
Honestly, I don't remember thinking about it a whole lot. And this sounds like I'm trying to avoid the question, but I think, you know, my job's not to make an impact. My job's really just as a storyteller. And so whatever happens afterward, I'm not that concerned about. I suppose I suspected that selfishly, this would mean the Times would probably want me to do more rock climbing stories. And I suppose I realized that, you know, publicly this would sort of help thrust rock climbing even further into the public realm. That, you know, not just the New York Times, but others would see like there's a viable category here of potential coverage. But I didn't have the foresight to expect, you know, what might happen. You know, certainly didn't know what would happen with Free Solo or with the Don Juan movie or, you know, that climbing joining the Olympics. I mean, how any of this all fits together, I'm not smart enough to tell you. I don't know if this is like a logical progression or not.
Well, I think the story angle that we're pursuing for this is just that it's all your fault, basically, that climbing taking off is because of you. Just because it's a fun and interesting approach to this. Because certainly, I mean, climbing has really been snowballing, and it's hard to pinpoint the exact moment when somebody pushed that first little snowball down the hill and it kind of started. But it basically started with Valley Uprising or the Dawn Wall. Certainly by the time Free Solo and the Olympics comes along, like, it's already a big snowball going downhill pretty fast. And so I think, you know, chatting with you, it's fun to sort of explore, like, what is that moment where climbing suddenly really went mainstream? And, you know, I think there is a potential argument to say that you did it.
Well, thanks, question mark, or I'm sorry, exclamation point. Yeah, I mean, I'll let you and, you know, you people that live in this world, I'll let you guys decide. It is interesting to think, like, when history books are written, like, when you guys look at the 2010s, whatever we call this decade, it's kind of like the decade where rock climbing really sort of went from somewhat of a niche, you know, always cool, but somewhat countercultural back and kind of thrust itself into the mainstream.
Well, yeah, I mean, right now it feels like the 2010s is the decade that climbing took off. On the other hand, if climbing continues to snowball and get more and more popular and more gyms open, and, you know, if climbing becomes the most popular sport at the next Olympics or something, you know, or right. Like if Americans win climbing in LA in 2028, you know, things like that, like if it really blows up, then maybe the 2020s will be the time that climbing goes mainstream. You know, it's suddenly like the next softball or something. You know, if you were looking for sort of inflection points, though, in climbing's growth, the right. Dawn Wall coverage is certainly one of them, because you just couldn't have the release of the Dawn Wall film or, you know, subsequently the popularity of Free Solo without all that coverage.
Well, I'm glad to be a small part of it, as long as people feel like we didn't, you know, somehow poison the water to some extent or anything.
Actually, if anything, I think you tilled the soil, or you like fertilized the soil, because the thing is, like, you know, no one can really understand the importance of free climbing the Dawn Wall or free soloing El Cap without knowing what El Cap is or where it is. I mean, basically, you guys did such a service in educating the public as to what climbing is and how it works, that I think that really allowed a lot of other, you know, aspects of climbing coverage to bloom. We'll be back with more after the break.
We just sort of happened across this very intriguing form of storytelling. Like the fact that we were up there for 19 days and people could follow along every day and like get these updates, that's kind of exciting. It's like if you think about the Olympics or something, is this a big event that lasts, you know, 2 weeks? Yeah, so you're excited about the next stage every day. And I think a two-week story that's unfolding real time is, it just happens to be this really incredibly exciting way to be a spectator, I guess. And we didn't realize that ahead of time.
I mean, how much of it do you feel like you were reporting the news, and how much of it is creating the news? You know, because when you make it a story and then everybody else piles on, because I remember showing up back in Yosemite and there were news vans and like satellites and, you know, the kind of stuff you see in a TV show, like all along El Cap Meadow. And especially in the winter when normally Yosemite is completely dead. It's like, this is insane. You know, there were so many news vans and so many reporters just kind of like taking video of the wall, you know, which thousands of feet away, it's like little tiny dots. I was like, wow, this is surreal. But, you know, how much of that do you feel like you created, basically?
Yeah, if we did create it, and whether it's blame or credit or whatever, it wasn't on purpose in any way. I think we just sniffed out a compelling story, and apparently everybody else thought it was compelling as well. I will say it is weird, because that doesn't happen very often. You know, I do a lot of stories on people where I'm the only reporter all along, and then we publish this big story, and maybe then people say, oh, this is somebody we should pay attention to or something. But to have it happen in real time was really strange. And I remember I left for a couple of days, because I went to do then a profile of Jorgensen. I went back to Santa Rosa and then came back to Yosemite. And when I came back, as you said, there were TV trucks. I was like, oh, shit, like, what is going on here? I was enough in that bubble that I didn't really realize the other media interest in it. When I got back to the Valley, I was like, oh, man, this is something now.
Yeah, I mean, no matter what, the Dawn Wall would have been the biggest story in the climbing world and the outdoor world. And, you know, it still would have gotten a ton of coverage within the normal spheres.
Yeah.
But I think the New York Times coverage really pushed it into the mainstream more. And I mean, you know, they went on Ellen right after they sent. That's I think that's probably the first and only time that a rock climber has been on Ellen.
The entire world was watching you try to accomplish it. And I just thought, why?
I think I got to quote Johnny Cash. If you're going to be dumb, you better be tough.
Uh-huh. I was climbing with Tommy right after, and he had to like dip out to go to Ellen. And you're like, oh, yeah, cool. As one does, you know.
As one does. How many times have you been on Ellen?
Yeah, no, I've never been. I've never met Ellen. So
maybe you should try to do something that's meaningful and memorable. She might invite you. Had this been anywhere else generally where trucks couldn't get to? and they couldn't literally just park and aim a camera at it, I don't know if this would have been the same thing either. Just the accessibility of the wall didn't take a whole lot of effort for media to come and do this. And so I think a lot of those factors just combined together to make this thing blow up.
Yeah, that's a interesting distinction, because even if they'd been climbing on something like Half Dome, which is just, yep, you know, 5 miles up the valley, you just can't park a truck at the bottom, and it's so much higher you can't see it that well, and it'd be really hard to shoot something of somebody climbing on Half Dome. But on El Cap, it's super easy. You're kind of like, right, you know, on this wall we can make an international news sensation. On any other wall, it's like not really possible.
You know, had you done the free solo somewhere else and everybody in the climbing world knew this was the baddest ass thing that's ever happened, but it happened someplace that nobody could really envision, nobody could ever see because it was so remote in a foreign country, it's different than it happening in El Cap with people standing in the valley watching.
Well, and that's an easy assertion to check, because I have in fact done that quite a bit, and nobody knows anything about them.
Exactly. Yeah,
I mean, you know, exactly. not quite as hard as El Cap, but there are tons of solos like that. Like, I made a list a while back, and I've done something like 35 solos that haven't been done before, like things that are sort of cutting edge. And yep, of those, like maybe 10 of them have been sort of shot or like reported in different ways, like sort of, you know, became a thing, like got filmed or took photographs or whatever. And so then there's something like 20 of them that there are no pictures, there's no story, they're literally just in my journal. And it is interesting to see which ones become a story and which ones don't.
Yeah, I think that sometimes becomes part of the calculus for editors. It's like, well, where is this taking place? You know, can we get to it? And does it have some sort of resonance, I guess, with readers?
How did the Dawn Wall change your career?
I mean, it was definitely a blessing and a curse. It definitely changed my career and my life in a lot of ways. Like, still to this day, 8 years later or whatever, I get recognized kind of wherever I go. Like, I was just in Europe and I get recognized in the train stations in Europe or in airports or whatever. I feel pretty stable about supporting my family as a climber, which I kind of never thought that would be the case. And now I feel like it's the case and I'm psyched about that. But also, I think I enjoy the kind of life where I could focus on singular things very intensely, like the Dawn Wall. And my life's just not like that anymore. I feel like I'm pulled in a million different directions all the time. And so it's getting pretty good now. Like, I feel like I'm in a good spot now, but it's taken a good like 5-6 years to figure out how to manage all that.
As you were writing the stories, did you have some sense of what it was going to do to Tommy and Kevin's lives?
I think probably halfway through, when I saw the TV trucks and when I got a sense that they were kind of clamping down on their availability, I realized, boy, the pressure on these guys now. I mean, it was one thing to have this dopey New York Times reporter standing there, but to have like TV trucks and they can see it all happening and they're getting their phones are lighting up from publicity people saying, we would love to have you on the Today Show tomorrow. And I don't know how they could have gone through that.
Yeah, how they handled the pressure. It is kind of amazing. I mean, that's what I think is so incredible about the whole Dawn Wall story, is that it's already one of the hardest, I mean, you know, at the time, the hardest big wall ever climbed.
Yeah.
It's like this incredible athletic feat, you know, this incredible adventure, and then you add the crazy public pressure and the public scrutiny and just the, I mean, yeah, just the, I can't get over the vision of the news trucks. It's like, man, El Cap Meadow is insane, you know. I've never seen anything like it.
But I write stories sometimes where I think, oh, this is really gonna grab some sort of attention or do really well, and it just goes flat. And sometimes you're like, really, that story kind of went nuts? You just never know. And so I gave up a long time ago trying to predict like what stories are going to do. What's tricky about something like Dawn Wall, not knowing if they're going to top out or not, most of the other events we're talking about, let's say surfing, we know there's going to be a winner at the end. Or, you know, sport climbing, we know there's going to be a winner crowned at the end. And so I think we're just leery about pursuits that are either yes or no, and diving into them and spending time and resources on something that may actually just never happen. So we really have to pick our spots. And I think Dawn Wall was different because, again, because of the credibility of Tommy and because of the location, that it was, you know, not difficult to just send a reporter up there and go check it out.
So maybe we should credit the birth of modern climbing to the Tommy Caldwell. Like, without his sterling reputation and his just charisma, you know, then climbing doesn't take off without sweet Tommy.
Did you sense that acceleration in climbing kind of in the mid-teens too?
Yeah, I definitely sensed it. And I've heard it from a lot of climbing gym owners, some good friends of mine who own gyms in Boulder and Denver, they said that because of the Dawn Wall and right after the Dawn Wall, they had like floods of people coming in. They're basically like, I'd go to the gym and they'd be like, thank you. Oh my God, this is kind of incredible. So many people are coming into the gym now. And so it became more financially good. And so then therefore more gyms opened. Yeah, I feel like that all contributed.
So of all the reporting that you did on the Dawn Wall, how much of it do you feel like was educational? Like basically teaching people what climbing is, what free climbing means, like what they're actually doing up there.
Yeah, certainly a lot of it. And again, this is what happens when I write about sports that are somewhat of a niche, right? I mean, it can be surfing or skateboarding or snowboarding or climbing or ultra running. There's a world, a small universe of people that really, really deeply care about that. And then the 98% of the rest of the world doesn't know much about it at all. And so whenever I'm writing about something, and I know this happened with the Dawn Wall, when I'm writing about something and I get comments from climbers or I hear people like, oh, teasing us about how we had to like dumb this down. Like, I'm not writing for climbers. I'm writing for my grandmother on the Upper East Side or for the businessman in Hong Kong or whatever. Like, it's not about you. It's about other people. So there is an educational component, a huge educational component on this. And so that first story, and I have not gone back because I don't tend to go back and read my stories, but I'm sure I would wince at some of the things we had to describe. And I remember having a question in a couple stories I've written since then. Like, can I say carabiner without explaining what a carabiner is? Right? Those are like the kinds of questions we have to ask when we write these things. And I think that's when I roped you into this a little bit to say, can you help sort of be our expert and one of our experts to explain this to people? But there were very basic questions that for climbers, I'm sure they looked at that next day story going, really, New York Times? But these are the questions that our readers were asking. And it was just a product of the fact that they were suddenly interested in something that they had no idea about before. And I think sort of the magic of the story, I think kind of what we're getting to here, is that the day before these stories started to run, you had people who didn't know anything about this, who had never heard of Tommy Caldwell, who maybe had a vague idea of where Yosemite or El Cap was. But 3 or 4 days into it, now they have like this vested interest and now they're like rooting them on. And it's not unlike what you see maybe during like the Olympics, where people have no idea. They couldn't name a figure skater to save their life. But all of a sudden on a Tuesday night in February, they are living and dying with whether this person's going to fall or not. Like that just kind of happens. And I think it happened with the Dawn Wall. We took something that 98% of the people knew nothing about and suddenly got people to care about it, at least for that moment. And if there's residual effects of that, great, but it certainly wasn't part of any plan.
Next week, we go a little deeper with Tommy Caldwell about the impacts of the Dawn Wall media coverage on his life. Climbing Gold is a production of Duct Tape Thin Beer. Alex Honnold is our host. Today's episode was written and edited by Andrew Burton and me, Fitzka Hall. Additional production help from Lauren Delaney Miller and Evan Phillips. Additional editing by Matt Martin. Music today by Brennan O'Connell, Dame Sue, Wildness, and Faring. Social media support by Jake Wheeler. Our executive producers are Lisi Hendricks and Becca Call for Duct Tape Thin Beer, and Jonathan Redzek and Ben Endy for RXR Sports. Thanks for listening.